Sherry.
Committee two provides that the personal representative can withhold from any distribution to a distributee any amount that is owed by the distributee to him. And this right of offset is ahead of any judgment creditor's claims or any other. This is a really codification of the off law and order today. This provision permits the personal representative to make delivery of property belonging to a resident estate to a foreign representative. But the court has got to find that that personal representative, foreign representative, has paid whatever debts, taxes, or charges are chargeable because this is a beneficiary from a foreign jurisdiction.
Our taxes, their taxes.
The taxes to the state on that. There might be an enforcement of the inheritance taxes, and that would have to be paid.
Clearly, we're talking about our taxes.
Also, their taxes.
Their taxes.
When the estate in Oregon is closed.
This is clear that it is for their.
For their purpose.
All right, 184.
This section is a rehash of our present section on the compensation of the personal representative. I'm informed that there are no changes in the fees which are charged, excepting, I think, on 1% on the jointly held property. That's line 3, page 69. This is 1% of the jointly held property, tenancy by the entirety, and so forth. That doesn't include life insurance proceeds.
Why the issue?
Well, I really am not in a position to answer that. I think Stan.
You mean why the addition of the 1%? I suppose because the minimum fee bar schedule for attorneys provides for a percentage of the non-voting.
Yeah, but that's a reason.
Mr. Chairman, may I try to answer?
Supposed to bear some relation to work done. How does this relate to work done?
Stan?
The original draft that we worked on provided for a not a substantial increase, but a measurable increase in the scale of the compensation. But toward the end of this thing, we realized that when you got into figures and trying to increase the figures of the compensation, which everything else has gone up, so to speak, but it was decided it was much more sensible to leave the rates as they were, and not inject a controversial feature into this code. That was the basis of adopting the same rates. But by the same token, since a personal representative, this only has to do with the obviously the substantial estates where you have measurable non-probate assets. The personal representative has to administer for federal state tax purposes on the entire federal and state taxable property.
Stan, and, pardon the interruption, but did the banks have anything to do with this? Actually, your property held as tenants by the entireties, and they handle the bulk of the estates in this country, and I represent them frequently. But what work is there in connection with the administering of a $100,000 piece of property held as tenants by the entirety, or securities held with the right of survivorship, or joint bank accounts, or anything else?
Occasionally, Mr. Chairman, there is a problem with joint ownership funds of proving to whom these funds belong. And I think there is a situation where maybe a husband and wife have a joint bank account.
But you're extraordinary, Chase Carapace. Mr. Chairman, let me make my heretical pitch here. I'll feel that I haven't made it. I have never been able to justify compensation for personal representatives or attorneys based on percentage of the estate.
How about personal legal case?
Now you're a meddler.
I offer to every person who comes to me about a personal injury case the option of either my billing them on a monthly basis for the work that I do, with the understanding that I'm going to be paid regularly, or taking on a contingency.
That may be true, John, but that's what you do. But would you be willing to introduce or suggest a law here that the contingent fee basis be altered by statute?
I'd be willing to. Wait a second. My opinion is that fees should not be fixed by statute, including fees here not be fixed by statute. I would much prefer, and when I'm done making my speech, I'm going to make a more serious motion. But when I'm done making, I can't justify, and I have more criticism of Lehman on the subject of percentage fees without any particular relation to work. And having made my speech and knowing you disagree, I move that lines 3 through 5 on page 69 be stricken.
You heard the motion. Any discussion? Not all those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
2-1.
That's a good one. I don't think it has anything to do with the contingent fees. I think it's an entirely different situation. The contingent fee thing.
Pick
the
result.
Is the one who's mainly responsible for producing it.
Yeah, I was about to say I'd be willing to take an estate on a contingent fee if that's what you.
How do you do it? Vote it in, right? I don't know the rest.
I vote it aye. I vote no.
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 I vote no. It's 3-3. Motion failed.
Mr. Chairman.
We'll take it back up.
We move it back.
I thought I was carrying out the chair's wishes.
Well, you are actually. That's why I say we'll come back.
Mind form, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I'm not just really trying to nitpick this. I'm just trying to figure out what the comma does there. The comma's around exclusions of life insurance proceeds, I can see. But is there some significance to that comma? For the English language, it is a requisite. And I'm wondering if somebody will pick it up later and say, can you say anything offhand, Bob? The comma doesn't.
You have to court?
Yes.
It's comma where you use a but, which is.
Well, but if it has a clause, and this doesn't have a clause. A clause would include a subject and a predicate. This doesn't have any subject.
It's true. The clause probably should have a subject. Sure.
I just like to make sure there's no significance to that comma.
There's no significance to that comma, other than what it's apparently normally took far above.
The trend these days is to drop commas in conjunctive clauses with and but before.
Matter of fact, the new one is on less, as I recall.
Do you want to take it out?
I'd like to see it out. I don't think it.
All right, Senator Moveland moves that the comma following the word part of line 4, page 69 be deleted. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Motion's carried.
Motion's carried.
Yeah, we'll agree to you.
I don't think they're serious.
Are we down line 10 or are we on?
10. 10 simply says that the PR can take, if there's a special provision made in the will, either that he takes no compensation or that he takes X dollars, that he can't take any other compensation. But he doesn't have to live with that if he doesn't want to. He can refuse to be bound by that.
Well, that's, Mr. Chairman, here's my precise point. Suppose that the decedent says that the personal representative shall be compensated in the sum of $1,000 for handling this estate.
And the person representative says, we don't want to be bound by that. We, your friendly bank, file a written renunciation of the $1,000, and we'll take a statutory fee. Is that what you mean?
No, I don't think so. I think all it means is that there could be a provision in the bill that needs to get $1,000, and he can renounce receiving that $1,000.
The way I read this, it essentially means that if he doesn't like $1,000, he can renounce it, and then he gets the normal fee. And I think what
you use the job and somebody else takes it.
Is that your idea?
No, I'm willing to have him do that, but I'm not willing to have him renounce. The only reason that a decedent would make a special provision for a fee would be to make a lesser fee than these percentages.
I'm not sure at all.
Chairman, I think this is our present provision as I read my notes.
The only ones of these I've ever sent, and where people want to fix a fee based on work done rather than on percentage of the state. And I fear, the way I read this language, with or without comments, you're saying that the personal representative has his options. He gets $1,000 or he gets whatever higher sum the state totals out.
I believe that's what it says. But I'm not sure if that's what they meant to say.
Well, I guess a decedent should be allowed to limit this in his own will.
This, Bob pointed out, this is essentially the same provision that appears in ORS 117.660.
Read that to us.
Right. This deals with the expenses and compensation of representatives. An executor or administrator is allowed in the settlement of his account all necessary expenses incurred in the care, management, and settlement of the estate, including reasonable attorney's fees and any necessary litigation or matter requiring legal advice or counsel. For his services, he shall receive such compensation as the law provides. Here's the part. But when the deceased, by his will, has made special provision for the compensation of his executor, such executor is not entitled to any other compensation for his services unless within 10 days after his appointment, he subscribes and files with the clerk a written declaration renouncing the compensation provided by the will. Now, the change has to do with the time of in filing this renunciation rather
than. That's what they mean, Don.
Yeah, I'm sure that's what they mean, but this is utter nonsense.
I mean, it's not a lie.
Yeah,
you want to tell you why?
Yeah.
All right, supposing I try to limit it. Suppose I say he shall serve without compensation or giving security, which is pretty.
Then he says, I don't take the job.
He says, I don't take the job, so an administrator is appointed and then gets the statutory compensation. He hasn't accomplished one damn thing. Right.
The way you normally do this, I've had this fairly recently, is the test takers came into the office making a will and made a deal with the proposed executrix saying, here's what she agrees to be paid.
You talk about a contract that's legally enforceable? She's going to become
executive? No.
Well, why can't she renounce then, Don?
Because, look, the theory of a will is that a decedent is allowed to have a little bit of control of what happens.
Including support for his spouse, for his children, all of the things we've talked about
in
3 or 4 days.
A little bit of control. And if
he has none.
All right. I think that a decedent should have some control over what happens. And if a decedent says $1,000, and if his friend is named in the will as executor, the friend should either do it for $1,000 and not do it. I think this is as much of a breach of the faith of the dead person as you can get. I'm always with
you. You think that dead person comes named? You think he intends this? I want my son Bill Jones, reading spirit, whom I have confidence, be my administrator, executor, I'm going to provide $500,000 to him. I'm going to provide that he shall receive $1,000. You think that his intention was further, and if he refuses to do it for $1,000, I direct that the court appoint anyone else whom it wants and pay $5,000 to him. You think that's the intent?
Wills are drawn by attorneys. Attorneys. Before they write in such a provision, I do this, discuss with the person what's involved here. But it's essentially, all this provision is doing, as it now stands, is saying that you can negate an express stated intention of a test taker. Anyway, we discussed that. I move that.
Well, you're assuming that the express intention is less, Don. All right, go ahead. I'll discuss that after you make your
motion. Yeah, I move we strike subparagraph 3.
Mr. Chairman, underline that. He's assuming in his whole discussion that the testator is trying to limit the money below the statutory amount, where the testator might want to award a loyal son and give him a little bit extra share by acting as his personal representative.
Say so. I can say so.
Who, the testator?
It's his will, he thinks about it.
Is there a call for the question? All those in favor of the motion of deletion will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Mr. Chairman, one other motion while I'm so sore. I made my motion and I'm done. I move that we strike from 184 all language after the word order in line 28 of page 68. So the whole section will read, upon application to the court, a FERC representative entitled to receive compensation for services provided in this section. There's more than one personal representative acting concurrently, the compensation will not be increased, may be divided among them as they agree or as the court may order. Period. And I call for the question on the motion.
All those in favor will say aye.
Just a minute.
Pardon me, Don. If this was done, then the court approves compensation of the representative.
You're moving to strike what? That's what I'm asking.
I'm moving to strike everything past that word order for the rest of this whole section 184.
Striking the part that over in subsection 2 that in all such cases such further compensation may be had.
Sorry, pardon me. I move to strike everything after the word order on line 28, but not striking subparagraph 2 on. No, I'm striking that because the court in its compensation will take care of everybody.
All those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
No. Motion is failed. Will you go on to section 185?
The 185 provides that the PR is entitled to repayment expenses incurred by him for the care, management, and settlement of the estate, including reasonable fee for appraisers, attorneys, and other qualified persons. And then he also is entitled to reimbursement for expenses incurred or he in good faith and with just cause prosecutes or defends an action, including reasonable attorney's fees. Section 186, I'd like Bob to explain to you just what this order of his chief provision is. Bob, would you
Mr. Allison, Mike, you better
maybe Mr. Mr. Chairman, I might say that after this draft was put together, we had tried to simplify the order as chief, but it wasn't too satisfactory. We had a session with the representative of the state land board, I like to call it that, if you don't mind. And we came up with an entirely different situation. As you know now, we have we have three different processes of looking after this cheated property. We have probate where they have to get copies of every notice and all the way along the line to be delivered. Then they can have a non-probate proceeding. And then they can bring a third proceeding. The gist of our conversation was that we now provide that in an escheated estate, the notice is given to the state land board on the initiation of probate. They get the notice right in the first filing of the petition. And in our order of priority, we provide that if you don't have any of these other people, that the order of priority for the appointment of the personal representative is the director of state lands. In other words, instead of getting copies of everything, he becomes the personal representative. And so automatically he runs the estate. And then when the debts have been paid and the estate has gotten to the point where you've taken care of your creditors and the welfare and what might be against it, we provide in 183 186, we provide that any time after the 4 month period has elapsed to give the creditors a chance to come in this as cheated estate. As soon as that time is over, you have a summary order ordering that this estate as cheat to the state of Oregon, and the proceeds are automatically distributed to the Bureau of State Lands, and the estate is closed. And we avoid all of the expense of the normal procedure. And the representative of the state lands agreed with us that on this kind of a basis, and the publication of the notice to interested persons, which would be their expense, and that the actual cost to the state on this summary procedure would be less than what they are now handling in any of these other methods. He was all 100% in favor. It's a clean, clear way of giving this stuff over to the state without having all of the present procedures of the ordinary state.
Very well. 187 provides that if the PR can't within 30 days deliver to a distributee, either because the distributee won't take it or it can't be found, his share of the estate, that then the court can direct the PR to pay it over to the Division of State Lands, and it's thereafter handled in the same manner as any other property that's delivered to him to the State Lands Division. If you look at the next page at 120.130, that provides how you recover property which is escheated to the state of Oregon. I think you've all been confronted with a situation where maybe you've got a $5 bequest and the legatee says, no, I'm not going to take it. So then you're stuck. And under the present procedure, you pay it to the state county treasurer. Now you can pay it to the state division of state land. You mean as far as that particular credit? Do you want to go to him?
All right, you want to go ahead.
All right, 188 provides for the discharge of the PR upon his filing his receipts. It also provides, though, starting on line 15, that the court may, in its discretion, and within 1 year after the entry of the order of the discharge, permit a suit to be brought against him and his surety if the discharge was taken through mistake, inadvertence, or eyes, or excusable neglect of the claimant.
What's the present provision?
I don't think we have that provision in the present code.
What happens now? That's similar to the provision on the
116.195, I think ORS is a section.
What is it?
116.195. I have some language I've already written in here that can move an amendment on this very point.
188.
Yeah. Be line 18, after the word through, if we add the words fraud or misrepresentation to the personal representative, or his surety, or through. So this sentence would read, the court may, in its discretion, upon such terms as may be just, within 1 year after entering the order of discharge, permit a suit to be brought against the personal representative and his surety if the order of discharge was taken through fraud or misrepresentation of the personal representative or his surety,
or through the mistake, inadvertent surprise, or excusable neglect of the claimant. They make a 1-year statute of limitation on fraud and misrepresentation for this purpose. But I think that you ought to be able to, after a year after his estate exploded, maybe in this kind of thing. I may have to tie 141 back into that later, if you'll make a note.
Well, I don't see anything wrong with that.
The word mistake, inadvertent surprise, or excusable neglect come out of that section in that verse, or in chapter 18.
18.
Vacating a judgment, and then a year.
Judgment.
Standard
provision.
But if we added fraud in there, and then I tie it back for sure on this 141 where there's an insurance claim, I can do it for 1 year. But I think we ought to protect against where it's fraud or misrepresentation of the personal representative or surety, just as we're going to protect where it's the excusable neglect or inadvertence, et cetera, the claim.
After the surety, you would insert fraud or misrepresentation of the personal representative or surety?
Or his surety, or through.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All motion carried.
Section 199 has to do with the problem where you have real property within another county. This requires that only the certified copy of the decree of final distribution and order need to be filed in the other counties instead of that long-winded bunch of stuff that you have to file presently. I wondered, though, as I read that, if this shouldn't be the official records rather than the deed records. Is it under the state law now that, at least in our county, we talk in terms of official records?
Generally, it's referred to as the deed records. I think there are different kinds of records somehow.
All of our instruments now go into what's known as the official records. Whether it's deed, mortgage, whatever.
Statutes are not very clear.
Official is a more inclusive term.
Is that Ottawa's Jackson home?
No. I think we're doing it under a state statute.
Well, the present statute, 190, 160-190, says deed records.
Yeah.
Deed records are sure turned up in the title.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know what they're doing down in Jackson County, but I might say that our other statutes have numerous references to where mortgages are going to be recorded and where deeds are going to be recorded and so on, and it says either in deed records or mortgage records, so we do preserve
it. Why did you think it should be deed records?
Yeah. You sure pick it up the fastest in a title search in deed records, and I think it is. I would think it is.
Oh, yeah.
Section 190 provides for the reopening of estates. It simplifies the procedure. It can be reopened upon the petition of any interested party with such notice as the court may prescribe, and it isn't necessary to reappoint the original personal representative, but another one can be appointed.
May come.
Yes, after there's no limitation on them.
Mr. Chairman, this is probably the same as the present law. Is there judicial review of the denial of the petition to reopen?
Yes, I would think that it would be
set. Not a discretionary act.
No, I don't think so.
This may cover my question.
It covers much of the deed records.
Interesting. I hadn't run across this section. It's in the
second
report. This is chapter
117.
117.710.
Or for any other proper clause appearing in the court, we'd have an equity field to this Supreme Court.
I'm sure.
But this would cover the situation the newspaper people talking about if somebody showed up.
Mr. Chairman, one thing in there for that. Are we being unnecessarily restrictive in section 188, in line 17, when we say permit a suit to be brought rather than an action? When back in action,
definitions, we actually include suits and legal proceedings. Why restrict it to a suit? I can't think about it. There may be some other legal proceeding that you want to bring other than a suit. And why can't we say action which includes, by definition, suits and legal proceedings? I'd so move.
Are you clear back to the
I'm in line 17 on page 70.
Well, we've got a definition of that in the statute.
I know. We've got a definition of action, not of suit.
I thought action said all legal proceedings.
Right. The point is, I'm saying line 17 limits this to suit.
It doesn't say action. It says
all right. I move that suit be changed to action, line 17, page 70.
Your discussion. Tenderman moves that.
We'd have to make an action instead of a suit.
Suit be deleted and action be substituted. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. And a change to and.
Is there any place where there's a comma that you miss?
Oh, no. Motion carries.
And the first thing you know, I'll make you read the joke I gave you.
Requires the county clerk to furnish to the director of the Division of State Lands the names of the estates that have remained open for more than 3 years in which no heirs or other persons have appeared to claim the estate. Section 192 is a rehash of our present recovery of this cheated property, and frankly, I'm not sure of just what the changes are in that. You might want to skim through it, but really it's not directly related to probates. It's a matter that involves this cheat. After the property is gone to the estate, what do you do to get it back?
Bob, is there any substantial change?
The basic change, as I recall, is handle the recovery proceeding as a contested case under the Administrative Procedure Act with judicial review, as is decided in the APA, rather than handling it as a court proceeding.
Where do you find which?
Subsection 2, line 23. You knock it out of the court and put it into the Administrative Procedure Act. No, page 71, lines 22 and 23.
Section 193 is taken from sections 4-201, 202, and 203 of the Uniform Probate Code. It replaces ORS 116-186. The one thing, are any representatives of the press here, eliminates the publication required by the present statute when the property is over $500 in value. Is over $500 in value. It would shorten the period of 30 days after the death, where 90 days is now required after the first publication or after the death if no publication is required. The requirement that certified copies of letters be furnished is eliminated. A creditor may still require that he be furnished copy of letters in addition to the affidavit if he desires it for his own protection. the requirement of a lease, of a release by the state treasurer is also eliminated. The committee felt that this procedure was an improvement over the present provisions. They felt that the matter of not requiring a release is not particularly important, since apparently the releases have been given routinely anyway. So it apparently is of no practical significance.
I'm representing the press.
Except for the publication and the certified copy and certificate and stuff, how does this differ from what the law is now?
Have you got the president's quote?
Oh, Mr. Ferg. I think we're coming into the area now where the state treasurer is interested. Did you have a comment to make in connection with this?
Yes. I'm J.J. Furter of the Treasurer's Office, Mr. Chairman. And I am concerned with respect to the elimination of the release insofar as the state treasurer is concerned. I can visualize many instances where people may technically be legal residents of Oregon. And in this fast method of living today, spend most of their time in California and possibly have property down there that would require administration and may only have an Oregon intangible property that would not. I don't think that unless there might be heirs in Oregon that there would be any objection to, say, the commencement of the principal probate in California. Since there wouldn't need to be an administration in Oregon, no one would be concerned. But that would not necessarily establish domicile. And I think there should be a showing that this is the fact. Because many times we're involved in such controversies. I think it's extremely important that you retain some waiver or release from the state treasurer's office in this regard.
I don't think there was any significant objection to it at the time. It was felt that there just had not been, as a matter of practice, any problem, and they felt that there would be no problem in eliminating it. I think there's any strong feeling on that on the part of the committee.
Mr. Ferner, do you have the language with the conflict with the conflict?
I have nothing definite. I would suggest possibly that on line 12, after the word upon, use words, for example, release or waiver from the state treasurer for inheritance tax purposes, and an affidavit as the bill provides.
Upon a release or waiver from the state treasurer
for inheritance tax purposes, or something, some substitute.
There's a difference between a release and a waiver. We just don't know what it is.
What if we'd say upon the release or waiver from the state treasurer from inheritance taxes and an affidavit made by or on behalf?
First, upon a release or waiver. Well, why not just release? The president can be
All right.
My reference to both was designed one of those intend for both to be included.
Present statute says release.
Yeah.
Says release. Yes.
Yeah, I said like release, waiving, forever discharge.
Yeah.
How about a quit?
The world.
Yes, but how about a quit? Don't forget you need a quit in there.
From the beginning of the time until the date of these presents.
Somebody so move?
I so move.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Carry.
Mr. Chairman, one other comment. I'm wondering if the use of the limitation in the use of tangible personal property might not sometime prove troublesome. It would seem to me that it would be desirable to remove tangible in both instances that that word is used there, or include the word intangible along with tangible.
What line are you on, Jack?
You're thinking line six.
Yeah. Line six has tangible at the end for the first time, and then on line 10 at the beginning, the reference again is tangible.
I think he's got a good point. Why don't you just call it personal property, because it's defined as anything that isn't real property under our code.
Okay, I so move. Mr. Burton moves that the word tangible at the end of line six and the first word in line 10 be deleted. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Carry. I wonder if this isn't a pretty good place to stop.
Mr. Chairman, you deprived me of a good pun. I want you to know that I was going to ask how much further you were going to go.
Jermson and I got lost in chosen action.
What is that, co-ed or inco-ed?
Can we get that back
to this? Very cause. I chose her as you chose me.
A chosen action is a rich answer.
Oh. Chairman, just a moment.
I know that I told the committee that we probably wouldn't have a meeting tomorrow, but I don't know where we're going to get at this. But
tomorrow?
How about, Friday at 1 o'clock for an hour and a half?
Which committee? Well, I can be here Friday.
Can the rest of you be at 1 o'clock Friday? Stan, how is that?
I was going to try to give a little prospect of what time you might have to afford to apportionment of estate taxes is somewhat technical. States of absentee must be explained. When we get into the rest of it, the volume is larger because after that, the bulk of this is amendments. And many of the amendments are just simply to put a new category in their guardianship and conservatorship code of missing persons. So it should not take certainly more than, I wouldn't think, Mr. Chairman, more than a couple hours.
Jake, are the amendments or suggestions that you're going to have in connection with the inheritance tax that's going to take a long time?
No longer than possibly a minute or two more than I had to say today.
1 o'clock Friday.
We're not meeting tomorrow.
Mr. Chairman, could we start at a quarter one? I know everybody likes to have an hour left, but I missed a good part of the portion of the higher end budget. And
quarter one.
I'd like to.
12:45.
Start higher end.
Short lunch hour.
Well, boss is 2 o'clock.
We're just starting higher end now.
Oh, no.
Judiciary Committee will continue discussion of the probate code.
Now, just for the so we'll have it on record, what's your name, job, occupation, your position?
I'm Robert Gilley, lawyer from Portland, who has served on the State Bar Committee, which worked with the Probate Advisory Committee during most of the time that the probate code was under consideration.
I'm Campbell Richardson, attorney in Portland. And I also
off in 194.
This is the Uniform State Tax Apportionment Act with certain minor changes. At the present time, Oregon does not have apportionment tax statute except for certain provisions in the Inheritance Tax Code. And the case of Beatty versus Cake, which came down in 64 and 65, applied equitable apportionment rule in at least one situation. There's some uncertainty as to how far that case would be extended and to what fact situations. And this Uniform Act is one that has been adopted in a number of states, which sets forth in detail how taxes are to be apportioned between different beneficiaries when the will is otherwise signed. I don't know to what extent you want to go into the details of the section.
You're on 195 now.
Yes, section 194 is definitions. All of part 4 is this Uniform Act. Definitions are on 194.
Just what does 195 do? What does it say?
Basically, of course, it's a tax according to what you get. According to the way in which what you get influences the amount of the tax.
For example, if myself and someone else are the beneficiaries, I receive $200,000, the other receives $100,000.
Well, other things being equal, you can receive
$200,000. It's in proportion to the interest that each person bears for total.
Well, except, of course, for the so-called collateral tax, we have very good.
Yes.
We have a tax on the entire state for these areas.
Yeah. All right, go right ahead then, next section.
This section sets forth the procedure in which the apportionment is made. And subsection 2 is important. If for some reason it's inequitable to apportion interest and penalties, the court can, in its discretion, apportion the interest and penalties in an equitable way.
Did you have any examples of what might constitute something which was inequitable?
No, that's straight out of the Uniform Act. I don't think we even discussed it. Charges the personal representative for the interest and penalties caused by his negligence.
You're not in line 16. You're talking about the value of the interest of each person.
That's interesting. Yeah, in a different sense.
Yes, that's what confused me. Will I confuse anyone else?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it's
interesting. I'm calling for a vote on that.
This is exactly uniform language, act language, we'll use the word interest, one way 195, another way 196. And this is just not in.
I understand.
lending, perhaps.
All right, let's move on then to 197. What does that do?
Well, this requires or permits a person who is in possession of the property who is required to pay the tax to withhold from property distributable to any beneficiary the amount of tax attributable to that interest. For example, if the state with a specific request, which under this statute would be charged with the amount of tax, the personal representative to withhold the amount of tax because the personal representative would be required to pay.
Would this have any effect upon a will that says that before any bequests or legacies are paid or devices, that they, all of the inheritance and estate taxes will be paid?
The provision of the will in that particular situation in general
would control.
Would control. In other words, in the usual situation where the will spells out that the taxes would all be paid out of the residue on probate property and non-probate assets, for example, the provision of the will would control.
This is only where there is no provision for payment in the will.
Can I ask one question then, Mr. Richardson? Supposing the decedent dies and there's a joint account with the seed and some, well, some whatever it might be, those could be real substantial in many situations. Now then, can the personal representative do anything to withhold the payment of the money to the surviving joint owner?
I don't think so.
Well, I didn't see how
he could. Not well, sitting down here, if the lines on 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, so on, that the personal representative can recover.
Yes.
But, geez, that's a I know a situation I'm involved in right now where there's a real substantial sums of money going to various people. Johnny Hill accounts. As a matter of fact, it's about a 30-day extension. It's quite substantial.
The personal representative has a remedy to go after.
Yes.
So can't hold up the...
You change all your banking law and everything else if you were to provide that here's a joint account between a father and a son, a substantial amount. The father dies, there's a wife and other children there. If that personal representative, and immediately upon death, incidentally, this account becomes the property of the survivor, if you were to say the personal representative could go to the bank and prevent any distribution of that, now I can see how the state treasurer's office could do it, but not the personal representative.
Are
you going to
check on that, Jake?
No, I think that insofar as the administrator's or the executive's charge is concerned, I believe he must nevertheless make a diligent effort to collect the tax. Once he's done that, I think he's completed his responsibility. But beyond that, I don't think
that's what this says. This provides him a remedy.
Well, say that again.
I think you've got to be patient. Yes, and I think as a trustee, as might be the case in some instances, along with his responsibility as executive or administrator, I think he would nevertheless be expected to make a diligent effort see that that tax was paid. And of course, since the property is not in his custody, I think beyond that, why he couldn't do it. And I don't think that he should be obliged to under this particular section.
All right, 198.
This section generally allows to the recipient the benefit of deductions and credits which are attributable to his gift. For example, in a marital deduction situation, when the wife's portion going to the wife is not contributed to the amount of the federal estate tax, then there would be no tax, of course, to the next gift. Similarly, in connection with the inheritance tax, there is an exemption
what page is it?
76.
Oh, how about back on the...
Yeah, on section 198, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, this is section 198.
Oh, I don't know that. What was the line again?
Page 76, line 19, after the word amended.
Yes. As of January 1, 1969.
That is the date we use in the other one.
Yeah. Okay.
My comments, gentlemen, kind of the section apply to all of the subsections.
Yeah.
I just asked Mr. Gilley how many states have enacted. 25 have the statute.
All right, 199.
This provides that when you have a life estate and a remainder interest, the tax is charged against the principal. And it's not a portion of the life tenant and the remainder.
Explain that. Give us an example.
Well, property's left in trust, and the income payable to A for his life and to B. And let's say that this property, the fourth of the estate, belongs to all of his credits and so forth, should bear a quarter of the tax. This section says is if you charge the tax to the principal of the trust, you don't require the life tenant to pay X percent of the cap. There's a value judgment involved here, here the other way. This, I think, is the majority rule in the absence of statute.
Okay.
This section permits the personal representative or other person required to pay a tax to wait until 3 months after the final determination of the tax before they have any duty to go after someone for their share. And if you have a reasonable time after 3 months, and if you're unable to collect it within a reasonable time, this section provides that the personal representative or other person is not. Not charged with any liability for failure to collect. And it further provides that if he's unable to collect because, say, the person spent the money or died and dissipated or something, that tax that you didn't collect is a portion among the remaining people in that profession.
Now, is that it, the situation that you're talking about?
If you're a joint bank account, if you're a tenant bank account, then loan the money.
Well, that means that all those nephews and nieces could take their $15,000 or $20,000 and go south of it and tell them the knowledge that the person represented.
That's right.
He can commence an action.
Yes.
Is there any provision anywhere where the state treasurer can go after these people?
State treasurer could hold them.
Yeah, but the primary obligation is on the personal representative insofar as paying the state is concerned.
Not if it's on the survivor.
It's on the survivor?
Yes, but I do think that in connection with what I mentioned before, where there is an administration, I think that the administrator should exercise some
effort.
Personal effort to collect the tax. And of course, to the degree that he can or cannot cause us to proceed.
And what would you do in a case where there are joint accounts and the survivor of those accounts withdraws the money? And bank permits him to, and the personal representative waits for 3 months and then commences an action, and it's obvious that they have nothing. The tax has not been paid. What will the state do in that case?
Well, I think to begin with, the institution couldn't make the payment without the permission or waiver of the state treasurer. Of course, if we are guilty of some neglect in that respect, why?
There's your answer, Don.
And what you said the last part of that?
The institution, before they're allowed to make must have our permission.
Well, if you neglect, then what did you say?
If we neglect, well,
it's tough luck.
Tough luck on door shut. I'll come to the state of Oregon as far as any facts that we're entitled to is concerned.
Unless you can collect from some other source.
But I want to assure you that that doesn't happen. Ever.
I'm okay with that.
Now, there have been occasions when the banks do slip up on this, but they've picked up the cost of it. Yes.
That's the answer. All right, would you move on then?
Section 201 takes care of the client who's gone south if the other state has a similar statute. This would allow a foreign personal representative to come into our courts and to recover a proportionate amount of federal state tax or state inheritance tax from the person who's either domiciled in Oregon or who owns property in the state. So that conversely, if Don, husband, surviving joint tenant, had gone to California with the money. And California had a statute like this, the Oregon person representative, down there and chase him.
That's the same amount of the income tax that we have.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, pretty much not doing that.
And who will essentially reference the body of the uniform state act portion of the act? All right, Article 7, State of Absentee.
This is a rather far-reaching change designed to take care of the situation where the death of an individual is not ascertainable. A classical example is the plane that's overdue or the fishing boat that disappears off the coast, among other things. The present statute is in ORS 120.310 in the following sections on the states of persons presumed to be dead. And it comes into operation only if there's an unexplained absence of 7 years. That leaves a hiatus in many instances, or many possible instances, where nothing can be done. And this amendment purports to take care of that. It was felt that the 7-year period was unduly restrictive and rigid, and that there would be many cases where the death was morally certain but not provable, no body, in other words. And if proper protection were given to the person who has disappeared, but may still be alive, it would, in the first place, be constitutional, and in the second place, be fair, not only to the man, but also to his family and his creditors, and perhaps his business associates and others. The converse of the situation of the overdue airplane is the historic case of some years ago where the man, he was connected to the Olsen King, as long as, drove his car off a dock in Vancouver and attempted to make it appear that he was dead. Turned up some years later in South America. Well, now, the committee felt that he shouldn't have been afforded too much protection there, but nevertheless, under the statute, he would afford it to him. The first section, 203, requires that before the proceeding of the probate of the estate of an absentee can be commenced, there must be a case where, after diligent search, his whereabouts has been unknown for a period of not less than a year. Must be a stated period. And that the petitioner has reason to believe and believes the absentee to be dead, so that he couldn't come in just on a suspicion.
Could I ask a question?
Sure.
What grounds do you need for a conservator's presence?
Well, the conservator is appointed upon petition of the ward. We come a little later, in one of the amendments to the guardianship code, to a situation where a person is missing. Now, we had a struggle with terminology. This situation where we are pretty sure the guy's dead is called an estate of an absentee. The situation of the man for whom we propose to authorize the appointment of the guardian is called missing. Now, it could be that the terminology could be improved on, but that distinction has to be kept in mind. The guardianship statute, as we propose to amend it,
does not have any presumption of death at all. Quite the opposite. The assumption is that the person is alive.
So under the present state of the law, there's no way of protecting his property unless he's gone 7 years? Is that a fair?
There's no way of probating his estate, to put it that way. There is a provision, section 127.010, about the missing persons and a trustee, which is pretty restricted, and then a further series of sections 127.310 on persons missing during war. But we feel that those do not cover the situation by that the term conservatorship on the missing during war part.
I've had this situation twice, very recently, a year ago. The owner of several title companies had to explain later, flying to Ontario, this year. About 4 or 5 years ago, very prominent Japanese citizen, very well to do, fishing a boat, two others. The boat turned over, two of them swam ashore, the other didn't. We had problems with collecting on the insurance, probating the estate. Well, we did there, and I'm sure it wasn't valid. We went right ahead with the probate, in both and alleged that he was dead. And in both cases, they were discovered. One of them, the one in the river, was discovered, Hashitani, about before the estate was closed, but about 12, 14 months. And in the other one, he was discovered, we started the probate probably about 8 or 9 months after he disappeared, and he was discovered 2, 3 months later.
Discovered him dead.
Of course. Found, I should have said.
The personal representative would have his neck out a good country mile in those situations if he turned up alive.
In each case, it was a wife. A surviving wife who had been named in the will. Mm-hmm.
Was there any inconsistency between cutting this down to 7 to 1 and at the same time cutting down these 6 to 4 months and moving away with the application or reducing that?
I don't see any inconsistency. I think this is an excellent thing.
This does more than create a presumption of death. The year is a condition preceding to the commencement of the proceedings at all. And there has to be an allegation of probable death and belief in the fact that he is dead. Then, of course, we go on later, and as we'll see in a moment, the protections have been cranked into this for the alleged deceased.
You want to go ahead and then that's good.
Section 204 requires a hearing on a petition not less than 30 days after the date of its filing, unless the court sets an earlier date. And copies of the notice to the absentee at his last known address by registered mail and by postage prepaid letter to be forwarded through the United States Social Security Administration. They won't tell anybody where the Social Security registrant is, but they will forward mail. Satisfied ourselves that they wrote present time.
Bob, the registered mail there, but our general statute about where a register is used means also certified applied to this?
I think you could use certified in this case. You can use certified unless a statute that refers to registered mail does not say specifically you must get a return receipt. But you could use certified mail in place of registered mail under the general statute if you wish.
I think we had some reason for using the word registered here. I don't remember now what it was. Maybe Canada or Utah.
I can't remember.
Because in most instances we didn't.
I think we're laboring under the apprehension that registered mail also meant
return receipt request. It doesn't necessarily mean return receipt request.
There's a statute that says that if the statute said registered mail, certified mail is okay unless the terms of the statute really say registered mail.
Let's say they may now show there's some reason you could say registered rather than.
Mr. Chairman, I have a vague recollection of having pointed out to us some distinction in the postal laws and regulations that made it a little bit more certain, it seems, that the addressee of a registered mail letter might get it through more care and forwarding. I can't be specific. But
should we put after mail in the word only?
I don't think that would.
We need to go further than that. We have to say notwithstanding section so on.
The certified mail substitution will occur unless your statute specifically says you want registered mail return receipt requested.
I
I think it's all right.
It's a question of whether you need return receipt requested in this case.
Of course, the return receipt is the least important part of this. The point is not to prove that he got it, but to get it to him.
The thing about it is I find that an awful lot of times you can get a letter, an ordinary letter, to a guy who doesn't want to be found, a hell of a lot better to be registered. Because he won't call the post office to pick up his registered mail, but the postman leaves his mail at his mailbox, and he takes that in and opens it.
Yeah, and
I usually send them both in that situation.
Well, and if it requires him to sign the receipt, he's even less likely to do it.
Well.
And Social Security people will not forward one where there's a return receipt requested either.
That's right.
We're still missing two children for the last 3 years. And Social Security people won't do it. Just return the receipt request. So we send them, they get them, but we don't know where they are.
I just took care of a problem. I'm saying about when I find my disappearance. I don't have to check my Social Security.
Yeah.
Well, this, of course, requires forwarding through the Social Security Administration, and not by registered, but by postage prepaid letter. And then the B goes on to the requirements for copy being sent by ordinary mail to the devisees and heirs named in the petition. And then the court may order such additional notice by publication or other means by the same property. Which makes it possible, I think, to take care of extraordinary situations in the first session. Then section 205 calls for a guardian ad litem to represent the absentee at the hearing. And the court may direct him to make a search in such manner as the court considers advisable, including any or all of the following methods: publication, one or more suitable publications, notifying police officers, welfare agencies, appropriate locations, by engaging the services of an investigative agency. And 206 requires a hearing on the petition where the court determines whether the absentee has died and the date of death. That, of course, could be important for succession and jointly held properties and Social Security benefits and all manner of things. And also whether he died testate or intestate, which would be the least of the court's problems, I'm sure. And upon finding that he's died, the court grants letters. For appeal. Section 207 provides that the effect of such a finding is conclusive if the notice of the hearing is given as required and the court finds that diligent search has been made. That, of course, is inserted to keep the provision constitutional.
All right.
Section 208 provides that administration of the estate shall proceed as provided. I'm sorry, it's not here.
Well,
please up a little bit.
Well, what
and 209 provides for revocation if the man shows up. Seems unlikely that that would happen if all these precautions were taken, but it has to be provided for. And I think this is one of the most important parts of the whole chapter, the whole group of sections. The power of the personal representative terminates, except winding up. Section 210 precludes the claim by the absentee of any to any property that's been sold during the proceedings. This would be necessary, of course, in order to give any purchaser a good title. But the proceeds realized, so far as they remain in possession of the personal representative, do go back to the absentee. And then, however, after 5 years, he has no right to recover from the distributees. I beg your pardon. He does have a right to recover from the distributees, but I'm confused here.
For 5 years after this distribution, he has a right to recover. The proceeds are the estate in their hands. No right to recover. The purchaser is sold by the distributees.
Well, I confess I'm confused between that provision and the provision that the property sold, whether the absentee. he has no right in any property sold.
Well, that isn't the position. If it's been sold, it's in the hands of some third party.
Well, 32 and 33, doesn't that take care of it?
No right to recover from purchasers of property. I don't see how he'd have a right under the first subsection.
Well, I mean, any money they paid.
Subsection 1 covers sales by the personal representative.
Yes.
Subsection 2 covers sales by the distributee.
Oh, yes. I knew there was an answer. Thank you. So.
You feel it's necessary in here to provide that the personal representative will be absolved from any liability to the executed attorney? What have you done up to that point?
Well, if he's done it properly, I would say so, yes. Otherwise, it might be difficult to find someone willing to act as personal representative, like in the case that you mentioned, where he felt safe because it was the decedent's wife.
You think it's necessary to say that the personal representative acted properly, and the person shows up, then he is absolved from any liability by reason of what he has done prior to the reappearance of the
well, as long as he's done it properly. Now, of course, if he were the petitioner, that would be in a different capacity, but if he were the petitioner and willfully made false statements, I'm sure he'd be...
No, I'm assuming that he did everything properly.
Yes, I think that is true. I hate to try to persuade one of the banks to take on the executorship of a...
My question is, well, should we say here that he will not be liable for anything he has done?
If we don't imply it, I think we should say it, because that should
you
be the result.
You think we should lie at it sufficiently?
No. You got the representative, you got the petitioner, two separate people. And then maybe you want to put in a good faith requirement on the petitioner. And the personal representative, all he's going to do is pursuant to order of the court, he's protected.
Well, the petitioner is false if anything with the copy remedy against him. I'm worried about the personal representative.
How effective do you think is the sentence that starts on line 16 of 79? Acts of the personal representative before revocation are valid for all purposes. You don't think that comes?
I don't think that poses a question to my opinion.
Well, if an act is valid for all purposes, how can he lie?
Valid means that he's given good title.
All purposes.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if the general section providing for the liability of a personal representative might not apply here, because this man is a personal representative.
Yes.
He's not any sort of quasi-executor administrator. And on page 63, section 173, along in that part of the code somewhere, I'm quite sure that there is a delineation of the liabilities of a personal representative. That may not be the section, but there is a general section back in that part of the code.
I guess that provision is covered somewhere in this code. And I don't think the uniformed people and all the people can let that go by without being cut somewhere. Yeah.
That's fine.
Well, I think
all right, Bob, would you see if you can find something on that?
I think Bob's statement there about line 17, 16 and 17 take care of them.
Well, is this personal representative going to get a discharge the way any other personal representative?
If he
is going to get a discharge as any other personal representative, your section on discharge, I think, covers that, which is...
Look at page 50, section 136.
Yes.
136, 137.
What page on
50? Yeah, that's the section of 50.
That's personal liability. I think if you get the discharge under section 188, releases him from any duties and bars any future action or suit.
Now, I think the chairman's point was that the legislative history on this should clearly show that if the person does show up alive, there should be no personal liability on the part of the person representative. That
pursuant to the order of the court. You understand?
Perhaps it should go farther than that.
Not order of the court. No, we aren't got any order of the court.
Longer.
says any court having probate jurisdiction may revoke letters at any time upon proof of the presumed deceit is in fact a lie, for which all powers. But all receipts or disbursements of assets and other acts by him before revocation shall remain as valid as though such letters had not been revoked.
Yeah, that's the same. I think that's exactly what we said here.
I don't think that's it. Remain as valid as though they've not been revoked. If they're invalid for some other reason, they'd be invalid. I think that's better.
This gets it.
Language of the present code. It would be as valid as if the letters had not been. Much better. Mr. Things
read again. Just that. I think we shall authorize that.
It says, after which revocation, all the powers of the administrator should cease. But all receipts or disbursements of assets and other acts by him before revocation shall remain as valid.
Shall
remain as valid as though such letters had not been revoked.
All right, you want to make a motion?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, all I'm afraid of is that I can't think that we're going to discover too many bugs that aren't covered someplace in this code. Now, we might discover a few and be phenomenal if we haven't. And I'm afraid if we do something here, we're going to throw this thing out of kilter somewhere else.
We have in the room four people who have gone through this whole thing many times. Hopefully, four are good kind of keep track of this. And I assume when we're all done with it, we're going to get legislative counsel couple days to take a look at it anyway.
Oh, yeah. This read in this sentence we have, it's like read sentence. Upon proof that the absentee is alive, letters therefore granted shall be revoked. Acts of the personal representative before revocation of letters are as valid
shall
as
remain
as valid. Are as valid as though such letters have not been revoked. We use the word not, are not. Before revocation, are as valid as those such letters have not been revoked.
But after revocation,
not I guess. And you want to take out the words for all purposes. In other words, you'd add an as at the end of line 16, and after the word valid in 17, the words as those such letters have not been revoked. And delete the words for all purposes in line 17. Is that?
Yeah. Is the word for all purposes a cause or trouble of the purpose?
Yeah, and if we tie it in this way, that they're otherwise valid, they'd be valid in this case. That's what we're saying.
That's what I was trying to
do. What do you gentlemen think of that language that's been suggested?
Fine.
Bob? Senator Lent move. All in favor will say aye.
Aye. Aye.
No motions carried. Section 210. Covered that.
Yes.
211.
211 provides that for substitution of the absentee as plaintiff in actions which have been brought by his personal representative and also his defendant, provides that he needn't go to trial for less than 3 months after the day of substitution. That is a practical safeguard.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
I'm wondering about making that so mandatory. I'm willing to say that if the absentee is substituted as defendant, which not if you don't go to trial less than 3 months after the date of substitution. It seems to me that upon the good showing made and facts found by the court should have discretion to force the trial earlier. There may be times in which I get somebody who's injured who's dying. You can run into all sorts of problems. Just giving a guy an absolute right to a 3 months delay. There should be circumstances in which the court, by discretion, to force the trial earlier, and there'd always be an appeal for abuse of discretion.
But where it ends. Unless otherwise, correct.
Or if you want me to, I'll go ahead and try to work out a sentence that would modify this rather than hold everybody up this time.
Act compelled on line 5, unless good cause shall it. Well, I mean, that's the substance of what I'm saying.
It's a substance, but I'd rather do it by another sentence in which the court would actually have to make findings. As to what the basis upon which you ordered him to go to trial before.
Did you work with Bob on that?
Mr.
Chairman, Rich and I agree that it wouldn't be any great loss if the sentence were deleted. Surely because we pointed out the assembly on the sentence.
Well,
that's a solution because there would be the discretion.
Sure. I so moved, Mr. Chairman. Heard the motion all day.
Yes, moves.
Judge Jordan Stephens, Senator Ponson. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Motion is carried.
Don't you hold out your shingle after you get off this committee there.
The reserve is carried by, he made the motion, but he didn't vote for it, so he's still all right.
Mr. Chairman, that reminds me, when Janard Gleason was here, and he couldn't pass the bar, so he put in a law that anybody who'd been a member of the legislature for 3 seconds is automatically admitted to the American State Park.
Section 212 merely provides that the cost, expenses, and charges of the proceeding shall be paid out of the estate. But if the petition is not granted, the petitioner picks up the tab. I think why is it going to slow down in probably petitions?
Article 8.
I think it's Mr. Richardson's turn to talk and mine to think now.
All right.
He doesn't want you to forget thinking just because you're not talking.
Article 8 is the contains the changes in the inheritance tax law, which were felt necessary to conform to the other changes in the probate code. You're aware that there's an estate tax bill before the legislature. This was not incorporated in the probate code, and on the assumption that the inheritance tax statute will remain the way it is, we make basic changes in the procedural aspects of the form. It's the principal procedural change of the current law is that the determination of inheritance tax will be made by negotiation between the state and the state creditor. The current law, you file your inheritance tax report with the probate court, and the court issues an order determining the amount of the tax and forwards the order down to the state creditor. This bypasses that procedure unless you're unable to agree. If you're unable to agree with the state treasurer, then you go back to the probate code and the taxpayer files objections to the determination by the state treasurer. That's the principle.
I might supplement that by saying that the procedure proposed by Article 8 is almost identical with the procedure followed now in a non-probate estate, which has the advantages of keeping out of the public record detailed information on the assets that go to, we'll say, a widow or any other like these, of course. It does provide for very easy method by which the matter can be brought to the circuit court by a simple petition, and that is satisfactory. Then by direct appeal from the